Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. I'm Alex Lender, and today we're going to do Chapter 60 of Henry Ford's Unabridged, The International Jew, The World's Foremost Problem. And the name of this chapter is How Jewish International Finance Functions. So we've heard in the last few chapters about the creation of the Federal Reserve, and we're going to hear further on related points about how these international Jews, basically from Germany, Frankfurt on Main, and from Hamburg, like Paul Warburg, came over and devised, saw the U.S. system was antiquated, in their words, and they wanted to centralize everything in one U.S. bank that would have the right to print money. They didn't quite get that designed administratively, but they figured they could overcome the creation of a 12-bank system so that in de jure it might be 12 banks, but in reality it would be one lender of last resort that could price the money differently according to which sort of projects they wanted to favor and basically just control the economy and the money flows. And they got it in 1913. So everything that we do can be found at vnnforum.com. And as I've said, the article that we're going to discuss were written back in 1920, 1921, as I come to you today. This material is evergreen. That means it's always valuable and true, so long as Jews exist to bedevil white kind. What we're talking about here will be relevant, even though it's printed 100 years ago. That's why it doesn't have just historical value. That is, it's not just valuable in that it helps us understand what happened. It shows, so long as these same Jews are allowed to retain power, how they will act under pretty much any circumstances. That's what evergreen means. It's never not true. It's always true and relevant still. It's not merely of historical interest. Anyway, Chapter 60 and Chapter 61 will close out Volume 3, but we're going to do them separately, even though they're both also relate to finance, and then it turns to something else in Volume 4. These articles appeared in the Dearborn Independent. That's a Michigan paper owned by Henry Ford, and he charged his researchers with looking into the Jewish question as it became clear to him that there was some force out there controlling things that was very dangerous to Americanism, as they saw it back then. Much more definite thing than we would see today when we've had decades of propaganda teaching us that America's just a grab bag of people, nation of immigrants, a Jew-created meme that was not true. Anyway, let's get on with Chapter 60, How Jewish International Finance Functions. Epigraph. Such has been the development of international bankers that they can no longer be regarded in their professional capacity as the nationals of any country, entitled to do business under their own government's supervision exclusively. They are really world citizens with worldwide interests, and as such ought to be made amenable to some form of supranational control. That means a greater control than nations, like a UN or something, even though the UN did not exist. The League of Nations was in the offing back when this was written. And that quote, that epigraph, is from George Petullo in Saturday Evening Post. That was a big magazine back then. Beginning the chapter then. Not only did the Jewish financial firm of Kuhn Loeb and Company, that's who Warburg was, one of their principals, use far-sighted prudence in splitting its political support, as we heard last chapter. One Warburg supporting Wilson, another Warburg supporting Taft, and an unnamed member of the firm supporting Roosevelt, the three people. Remember when there was that split election, they were trying to, three of them were trying to run instead of just two. All at one time, as Paul M. Warburg testified, but it split its activities in several other ways also. The international interests of the Jews comprising this firm are worthy of note. The influence which forced the United States to repudiate a commercial treaty with Russia, while Russia was a friendly country, 1911, we heard about that in an earlier recording, earlier chapter, and thus to compel all business between the United States and Russia to pass through German Jewish hands, that would be the through Frankfurt, was generated by Jacob H. Schiff. And again, this Schiff is one who's married to Loeb, as Warburg, I believe, is. And Schiff is the one who funded the Japanese in their war with Russia. He funded the Jewish Bolshevist gangsters who overthrew Russia. So he's got his hands in every pot, and he also messed up our relations with Russia commercially earlier. So he's got his hands in every pie out there, and he's messing things up for the US. So he was the main director behind the forced repudiation of this treaty that was serving both Russia and US very well. The full story is told in the Dearborn Independent of January 15, 1921, under the title "Taft Once Tried to Resist the Jews and Failed." And as I said, we've already recorded that. Check VNNforum.com. And is reprinted in volume 2 of the booklet containing this series. Mr. Schiff's activity consisted in forcing the Congress of the United States to do a thing that was repugnant to the reason and conscience of President Taft, and which he personally refused to do or to recommend. Mr. Schiff left the White House in great anger with the threats. Yeah, they called a meeting and they thought they were going to press on him. All these Jews around the table were going to force him to take their agenda, but he'd already studied the matter and he said, "No, we're not doing that. It's, as he says, repugnant to reason and common sense, and it's simply dishonest." And they got angry because they didn't get their way, and they worked their way behind the scenes with all the congressmen across the nation until they got it reversed like 10 months later. Mr. Schiff left the White House in great anger with the threat, "This means war." Quote, "It did not mean as much war as it might have, for President Taft acquiesced gracefully in the Jewish victory and has since been extremely laudatory of them on the public platform." So, kind of being a conservative after originally being courageous. Mr. Schiff's firm also helped finance the Japanese war against Russia, and in return desired Japan as a Jewish ally. The wily Japs, however, saw the game and kept their relations with Mr. Schiff to purely business matters, which fact is well worth bearing in mind when reading the widespread propaganda for war with Russia. I'm sorry, widespread propaganda for war with Japan. If you will give so, Schiff sponsored them against Russia, but they just said, "Look, we'll do business with you. We need the money, but we want a good rate, and that's all the involvement we want." So, after that's all taken care of, suddenly there's this propaganda for a war with Japan. So, you know the Jewish connection there. If you will give particular attention, you will observe the same interests which are just now engaged in most loudly defending the Jew are most active in spreading anti-Japanese sentiments in this country. Just the way the neocons at the start of 2016 spread propaganda against Russia because it's one country that is resisting their attempt to dominate the globe and reorder the Middle East and some of the nations around Russia in order for it to be more to their liking and more under the Jewish thumb. The Japanese war with Russia, however, enabled Mr. Schiff to advance his plan to undermine the Russian Empire, as it has now been accomplished by Jewish Bolshevism. With funds provided by him, the basic principles of what is now known as Bolshevism were sown among the Russian prisoners of war in Japan, who were sent back as apostles of destruction. So there's a Russo-Japanese War, if you may recall, which has been said the first time that a non-white army defeated whites. In a war, at least, man, not a battle or something, but a whole war. And Jacob Schiff, this Jew, is financing propaganda, communist propaganda that's spread among these prisoners who then go back to Russia to help Trotsky and Lenin foment the Bolshevik Revolution. Russo-Japanese War was in 1905, remember? Sent back as apostles of destruction. Then followed the horrible murder of Nicholas Romanov, Tsar of Russia, with his wife, his crippled son, and his young daughters, the full tale of which has now been told by the Jew who managed the crime. For the part he played in destroying Russia, Mr. Schiff was wildly hailed in New York the night the news came that the emperor had abdicated. Meanwhile, the Jew who was, quote, "to take the Tsar's job," as the common New York ghetto phrase ran, weeks before the event, had left New York to be in waiting. This Jew was passed out of the United States at the request of a very high American personage whose subservience to the Jews was one of the marvels of the past 7 years. Halted by the British, this Jew was released from their toils at the request of a very high American personage, and thus the Jewish Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, The program of which was made in America was set in operation without a hitch. This whole firm is German-Jewish, its members having originated in Germany. It had German connections. How far it maintained those connections through all subsequent events is a separate question. Mr. Otto Kahn's allotted portion of the world seems to be Great Britain and France. Mr. Kahn is of German origin, like the rest of the firm, but he has not publicly shown such concern for Germany as have other members. Mr. Schiff was once very active for the settlement of a peace on the basis of a victorious Germany. Mr. Paul M. Warburg also had interest, discussion of which is postponed for the present. But Mr. Kahn succeeded, through the connivance of American authority, and the excessive repression of the newspapers, in conveying the impression that, by some species of occult separatism, he was not, quote, German-minded, unquote. Therefore, Mr. Kahn flits lightly everywhere, except Germany. He is sufficiently French to be able to tell in the first column on the first page of Le Matin, the afternoon, I think, or the more, Matin, it might be matinee, like the movie, afternoon showing. So this Jew is flitting among these countries. He's able to get the prime space on one of the main papers on what terms America will do business with Europe, and he speaks as one having authority. He is sufficiently British to have thought of standing for the British Parliament when an unfortunate event made it necessary for him to remain in the U.S. Mr. Kahn sometimes flits farther east into the more Jewish portions of Europe, and his comings and goings are marked by certain changes with which his name remains most ostentatiously disconnected. Remember what Disraeli said, the world is governed by very different personages than is suspected. They operate behind the scenes, they're not visible. On the surface, everything looks fine. Mr. Kahn has very recently been telling France on what terms the United States will help her. There apparently being no other spokesman, Mr. Kahn's word is accepted as authority. France is one of the most Judaized countries in the world, the haunt of international Jewish financiers who exercise their power, thus saving France the trouble of passing laws, to keep the emigrant Jews out of France, so that France presents the spectacle of being Judaized by Jewish finance and not by immigrant Semitic hordes. And thus is a fit platform from which Mr. Otto Hermann Kahn may utter his pronouncements. In his last declaration to France, Mr. Kahn prepares her to expect little by stating that America is a country of immense resources, but the actual money which the people have at their disposal is comparatively limited. Unquote. True enough, it was a member of Mr. Kahn's firm who invented a monetary system which was promised to keep money in more equal relation to wealth. But as he goes on telling what America will and will not do, the American people knowing nothing about it meanwhile, Mr. Kahn discovers with great enthusiasm a place where he thinks American capital can be placed, namely, in the development of the vast and immensely rich colonial empire of France. And pray, where is that? Any Frenchman would tell you now, in Syria. Syria, that part of the East where the natives are loudly complaining that the Jews are driving them out contrary to every written and moral law. The Jewish powers have already succeeded in getting French troops over there. Bad blood has been caused between France and Great Britain. The Jews on both sides are playing for the middle, and here is Mr. Otto Kahn himself pledging American capital to the development of the French colonial empire. Talk to any Syrian who knows his country's present status, and he will interrupt Mr. Kahn's words very vividly. So we see that right now Syria is a huge mess of war with ISIS, Russia bombing ISIS, the U.S. pretending to bomb ISIS, Israel pretending to bomb ISIS, when they're really trying to destroy Assad, the ruler of Syria, the proper ruler, the elected ruler of Syria, as part of their PNAC plan to get rid of 7 Middle East rulers in 5 years, I think it was. And they already succeeded with Iraq. They messed up Libya. And you see that they were meddling over there 100 years ago as well, even before Israel was created, and using American capital is this point in this chapter. One of the nicest bits of work Mr. Kahn has done is to denounce pro-German propaganda, in quotes, which he says has exasperated Americans in favor of France. Next to committing the United States to an undying admiration for Briand, this is really his finest bit, especially with partner Paul playing the German sympathy string. It is a great international orchestra, this Jewish financial firm. It can play the Star-Spangled Banner, Die Wacht am Rhein, the Marseillaise, and God Save the King in one harmonious rendering, paying obsequious attention to the prejudices of each. Next come the Warburgs. Their interest is, of course, in Germany. Paul stated in his testimony, given at the beginning of the World War, that he had interest in Hamburg and would dispose of them. We heard that last chapter. The war came on. The Jewish government in the United States was augmented. Mr. Warburg was no mean figure, as previous articles have shown. The Warburgs are three in number. Felix M. is the other one in America. He appears but slightly in public affairs, although he is a member of the American Jewish Committee and of the firm Kuhn Loeb & Company. His retiring habit, however, does not argue lack of consequence. He was of sufficient consequence, Jewishly, to have bestowed upon him a sort of honorary rabbinical degree of Haber. Haber, which H-A-B-E-R, in quotes, which entitles him to be known as, quote, Haber Rabbi Baruch Ben Moshe, unquote. Honorary rabbinical degree, a sort of honorary rabbinical degree of Haber. He is the only Jew in America upon whom the title has ever been conferred. Max Warburg represents the family in its native land. Max Warburg had as much to do with the German war government as his family and financial colleagues in America had to do with the United States war government. As has been recounted in the press the world over, the brother from America and the brother from Germany both met at Paris as government representatives in determining the peace. So ostensibly you have all these nations, but really they're just international Jews who are making all the decisions for the goyish countries to rule the nations. There were so many Jews in the German delegation that it was known by the term kosher, also as, quote, the Warburg delegation, unquote. And there were so many Jews in the American delegation that the delegates from the minor countries of Europe looked upon the United States as our Jewish country, he's talking about Romania and Poland, as we've heard earlier, which through unheard-of generosity had elected a non-Jew as its president. And they dictated rules that the Eastern European Goys found obnoxious because they privileged Jews over the natives at that Versailles peace treaty. Max Warburg is an interesting character also as regards the establishment of Bolshevism in Russia. The Jews had several objectives in the war, and one of these was to get Russia, in quotes. To this end, the German Jews worked very assiduously. Because Russia was a member of the Allies, the work of the German Jews was made the easier. But the fact Russia was an ally made no difference with the Jews who were resident in Allied countries. Win or lose, Russia must be destroyed. Remember, Russia was seen as their number one enemy. It is the testimony of history that it was not so much the German military prowess as the Jewish intrigue that accomplished the downfall of that empire. In this work, Max Warburg was a factor. His bank is noted in a dispatch published by the United States government as being one whence funds were forwarded to Trotsky for use in destroying Russia. Always against Russia, not for German reasons, but for Jewish reasons, which in this particular instance coincided. Warburg and Trotsky against Russia. Poor John Spargo, who ought to know better, denies all this. While every American who comes back from Russia, even those who went over there pro-Bolshevik, yes, and returned Jews themselves, proclaim it. The crushing fact is that Bolshevism is not only Jewish in Russia and in America, but it is Jewish in the higher regions of Jewry, where better things ought to exist. Take Walter Rathenau, a German Jew on the plain of the Warburgs. Rathenau was the inventor of the Bolshevik system of centralization of industry, material, and money. The Soviet government asked Rathenau directly for the plans and received them directly from him. Max Warburg's bank held the money. Walter Rathenau's mind held the plans, which makes it a pertinent question. If Bolshevism can be so Jewish outside of Russia, What hinders it being Jewish inside Russia? It is a most significant fact that, as in Washington, the most constant and privileged visitors to the White House were Jews. So in Berlin, the only private telephone wire to the Kaiser was owned by Walter Rathenau. Not even the Crown Prince could reach the Kaiser except through the ordinary telephone connections. It was the same in London. It was the same in Paris. It was the same in Petrograd. In Russia, which so persecuted the race that controlled it then and controls it now. So are you getting the picture that Jews completely control their money and media and communications? They have achieved a complete communication spectrum dominance over the Goyim. Now, this sketchy outline of the internationalism of the firm Kuhn Loeb & Company is not offered as the result of keen research, for the facts are found at the very surface of the matter for anyone to see. What is revealed by research is this. Whether Mr. Schiff's interest in Russia had underground features which affected the welfare of nations, whether Mr. Kahn's flitting missions here and there, which he made with great freedom during the war, were wholly taken up with the business announced in the public notices, and whether Mr. Warburg, whose interest in Germany has not abated, to judge from his recent utterances, was able to retain complete neutrality of mind during the war. These are questions of value. Obviously, they are not easy to answer, but they can be answered. It was a family enterprise, this international campaign. Jacob Schiff swore to destroy Russia. Paul M. Warburg was his brother-in-law, married to his sister. Felix Warburg was his son-in-law, married to his daughter. Max Warburg of the Hamburger, banker of the Bolsheviks, was thus the brother-in-law to Jacob Schiff's wife and daughter. So all these are Jews. They have the same blood, and they have the same ideas, and they have the same agenda, and they push it through. And that tight connection with blood and money and ideas is what allows them to triumph over our people. You see. Speaking of the far-sighted manner in which the House of Kuhn Loeb & Company disposes itself over world affairs, there is also the curious fact that in this Jewish firm is one who goes to a Christian church, a most heinous thing for a Jew to do. Split three ways in American politics, and as many ways as international matters require, we find this firm split two ways with regard to religion. Mr. Kahn professes, or at least attends, a Christian church and is accounted an adherent of it. Yet he is not ostracized. His name is not taboo. The Jews do not curse him. He is not denounced as a renegade. The Jews have not buried him out of mind as they do others who desert the faith. They actually even have a ritual for execrating those who leave the faith, as we've heard on other broadcasts. I forget the name of it, but they have it. It's sort of like an anti-mass type thing. This presents a strange situation when it is considered. Not to recount again the horror and reprehension and active antagonism which Jews view such a desertion, with which Jews view such a desertion, that is a Jew, apostasy. Suffice it to say that there is no greater marvel than that of Jacob H. Schiff retaining in the firm of Kuhn Loeb & Company a, quote, renegade, unquote, Jew. He could not have done it. Every fiber of his intensely Jewish nature would have rebelled against it. Yet there it is. Without going further into this ingenious system of covering all vital points from one center, enough has been said to show one busy Jewish financial firm with which political matters, national and international, is almost a profession. The family of Warburg, high in the controlling group of the two countries, and enemy countries at that, the family of Warburg high in the negotiations of world peace and the discussions of a League of Nations. The family of Warburg now advising the world from both sides of the earth what to do next. It was probably with more reason than the general public surmised that a New York paper printed during the peace conference an article headed, "Watch the Warburgs," in quotes. The fact seems to be that, as Mr. Petullo is quoted as saying at the head of this article, the international financiers have been so engrossed in world money that the sense of national responsibility sometimes becomes blurred in their minds. They desire everything, war, negotiations, and peace, to be conducted in such a way as to react favorably on the money market. For that is their market. Money is what they buy and sell, and because money has no fixed price, it is a market which offers the widest opportunity for the trickster and swindler. One cannot play such tricks with stone or corn or metals, but with money as the commodity, everything is possible. Mr. Warburg is already very much interested about the treatment to be accorded foreign securities in the next war. Readers of the daily newspapers may recall that recently a demand was made for the gold in the Reichsbank, which was resisted on the ground that the Reichsbank, although the Central Bank of Germany, was really a private concern, just as Paul Warburg said it was, and just as he insisted that our own Federal Reserve should be, and which it is. There is far-sighted wisdom in that, with a view to a possible defeat in a war. Mr. Warburg is apparently quite disapproving of the treatment accorded alien enemy property, quote, by some countries, unquote. He quotes a French banker throughout, nationality not stated, and drives his point home. The French banker used as an illustration a possible war between England and France, this was only last year, and said that the bankers in each country would proceed to withdraw their mutual balances and securities for fear of confiscation, and that such a course would precipitate a panic. To which Mr. Warburg adds, I think that our bankers ought to carefully to study this very serious question. We have nothing to gain and much to lose by joining in a policy of disregarding the rights of private property. We shall probably, in the course of time, become the largest owners of foreign securities and properties, which would become endangered in case we were drawn into war. To me, however, it is of greater interest that nothing be done that might stand in the way of making the United States the gold reserve country of the world. Says Ford, such talk passes with too little scrutiny. It bears a strong reflection of recent events which should not be overlooked. Moreover, it presents a grandiose vision which is supposed to command instant agreement because of its appeal to superficial national pride and selfish ambition. If what Mr. Warburg says is an intimation that the international Jews are planning to move their money market to the United States, it is safe to say that the United States does not want it. We have the warning of history as to what this would mean. It is meant that in turn Spain, Venice, Great Britain, or Germany receive the blame and suspicion of the world for what the Jewish financiers have done. It is a most important consideration that most of the national animosities that exist today arose out of a resentment against what Jewish money power did under the camouflage of national name. That's a very interesting point. The British did this. The Germans did this when it was the international Jew who did it, the nations being but the marked spaces on his checkerboard. Today around the world, the blaming word is heard, the United States did this. If it were not for the United States, the world would be in better shape. The Americans are a sordid, greedy, cruel people. God, they were saying that 100 years ago. Imagine how much more they would say today with Jews with their hand up our ass and operating us like a stupid puppet. Why? Because the Jewish money power is largely centered here and is making money out of both our immunity and Europe's distress, playing one against the other. And because so many of the so-called American businessmen abroad today are not Americans at all, they are Jews, and in many cases as misrepresentative of their own race as they are of the Americans. The United States does not want the transfer of all Judean to this soil. He's using an Anglicization of the German term, like all Juden. It means like what it sounds like. We do not desire to stand as a gold god above the nations. We would serve the nations and we would protect them, but we would do both in the basis of real values, not in the name or under the sign of gold. On the one hand, Mr. Warburg recites pitiful facts about Germany in order to raise sympathy for her, and on the other hand, he stimulates the gold lust of the United States. The plight of Germany is entirely due to the forces from which the United States has only narrowly escaped, and to hearken to international Jewish plans for the rehabilitation of Germany is to be in danger of approving plans which will fasten Jewish domination more strongly on that unhappy country than it is now. And remember, they were literally starving to death, a lot of those Germans, because of the forced blockade. Germany has paid dearly for her Jews. The Warburg voice that speaks for her would seem indeed to be the voice of Jacob, But the hand that proposes financial dealings is that of Esau. Remember, Jacob ripped off Esau. The internationalism of the Warburgs is no longer in doubt and cannot be denied. Felix Warburg hung on to the Hamburg connection longer than did Paul, but the breakage of either was probably perfunctory. At the same time that Felix left Hamburg, firm of his brother, the Hamburg firm of his brother, Max, Mr. Stern also left the Frankfurt firm of Stern, and both became very active on the Allies' side, taking sides against the German nation as lustily as anyone could. Impossible, say those who fancy that a German Jew is a German. Not at all impossible. The Jew's loyalty is to the Jewish nation. What the Jew himself refers to as his cover nationality may count or not as he himself elects. This statement is always met with frothing wrath by the Jews' quote, Gentile fronts, unquote, in the purchased pro-Jewish press. But here is an example. Do you remember the Beast of Berlin, that lurid piece of war propaganda? You did not know, perhaps, that its producer was a German Jew, Karl Lemel. His German birth did not prevent him making money out of the film, and his film does not prevent him annually going back in state to his birthplace. This year he goes accompanied by Abe Stern, his treasurer, Lee Kolmar, his director, and Harry Reichenbach, a list of names duplicable in any movie group. Messrs. Stern and Warburg of Frankfurt and Hamburg, respectively, and away from home perhaps only temporarily, were not concerned about the fate of the Huns, but they were immensely concerned about the fate of Jewish money power in Germany. To indicate how blind the public has been to the inter-allied Jewish character of much of the world's important international financial activity, note this from the italics Living Age, and earlier in the year, this is a block quote from Living Age, some kind of magazine. According to the Svensk Handelstidning, sounds like a trade magazine for Sweden, the recent American loan of $5 million to Norway was really the outcome of an agreement between the Hamburg firm of Warburg & Company and the New York bankers Kuhn & Loeb. It is regarded as a significant sign of the times that a German firm should be responsible for an American loan to a neutral country. The conditions subject to which this money was borrowed are not regarded as very favorable to Norway. No market effect on the rate of exchange between the two countries has followed. End quote. Note, says Ford, in the light of all the statements made about Kuhn Loeb & Company and the Warburgs in particular, the assumption in the above quotation that the transaction was really between a German and an American firm. It was principally an arrangement between the Warburgs themselves in family council. Not even between Jews, but between one damn Jew family. But the loan will pass in Norway as, quote, an American loan, unquote. And the fact that the terms of the loan, quote, are not regarded as very favorable to Norway, unquote, will react upon Scandinavian opinion of this country. It goes without saying that, quote, no market effect on the rate of exchange between the two countries is followed, for that would not be the object of such a loan. The dislocation of exchange is not unprofitable. It would be interesting, most interesting, to know in how far Kuhn Loeb & Company has endeavored to readjust the rate of exchange. During the war, Kuhn Loeb & Company made a loan to the city of Paris. Considerable German comment was occasioned by this, naturally. And it is very well worthy of record that in the city of Hamburg, where Max Warburg does business, the chief of police issued this order. Quote, further mention in the press of loans made by the firm of Kuhn Loeb & Company to the city of Paris and unfavorable comments thereon are forbidden. Well, how hilarious is that? Because today we see Angela Merkel fills Germany with millions of Syrians as a result of this war that Jews caused, Jews themselves in Israel not admitting a single Syrian immigrant, Syrian alien. And then Angela Merkel teams up with Jew Mark Zuckerberg and with other Jews at Yahoo and Google to suppress any criticism of what she has done to genetically destroy Germany as hate. And here we see that 100 years ago, this Max Warburg and these Jewish financiers operating out of Hamburg and Frankfurt had the exact same power to suppress any criticism of what they were doing to destroy the host country, or at least its reputation. Isn't that amazing? Jews never change their spot. There is no way to deal with them that is effective or that can work, save making them extinct. They're far too well networked. They have far too much power for anything else to work. you're not going to win them over to your Christianity that has no appeal for them, because it's it's a low standard. It's simply too low of a standard to interest them. It's, as someone said, it's basically Judaism with the nets down. As Frost said about tennis, and you know I love to quote that because it applies, it's so applicable to so many things, not just free verses he applied it to. It's, you know, there's no, you're no, if you don't have any standards or you don't have any rules, then there's no art to it or there's no seriousness to it, and that's what Christianity is. Now, the following story is vouched for as reliable, and if in one or two minor details it does not represent the exact fact, it is yet a trustworthy illustration of how certain things were done. And this will be, I think, an anecdote that will pretty much close this 60th chapter. But first, the block quote is the anecdote. A Jewish international banking concern bought up the mining and other similar concessions of Yugoslavia, and consequently the policy pushed at the peace conference was that which was most convenient for that group. An understanding on the Fiume question, F-I-U-M-E, was in progress between Wilson and Nitti. Certain concessions had been agreed upon, and Wilson was willing to negotiate, when Oscar Strauss and one of the Warburgs appeared on the scene. Wilson changed his attitude overnight, and afterward insisted on the Yugoslavia solution part of the problem. The way in which concessions had been bought through that territory was a disgrace, and observers expected that it would play an important part at the peace conference. So, again, their Jews are manipulating everything, serious, everything of any substantial money to their own benefit, in our name, and representing us. How ridiculous is that? We don't even know who we are, because Christianity confused us. Are we a religion? Are we a race? Are we a nation? What are we? We don't know. It's the first question, politically. The financiers are not the only international Jews in the world. The revolutionary Jews, of all countries and none, are international also. They have seized upon the idea of Christian internationalism, which means amity between nations, and have used it as a weapon with which to weaken nationality. They know as well as anyone that there can be no internationalism except on the basis of strong nationalism, but they count on cover words to advance their plan. Enough transpired between the lower and higher Jewish groups of every large center during the war to render it imperative that Jewry confess, repent, and repudiate the madness that has ruled it, or else boldly assert it and espouse it before the world. Certainly enough has transpired to render it desirable that the American people look again into the purposes of those Jews who were instrumental in reorganizing our financial system at a most critical time in the world's history. Max Warburg was apparently strong enough to suppress German discussion of his brother's activities in America. The Warburgs at present resident in America must suffer it, therefore, that American comment be made as full as need be. So, in other words, what the heck is going on here? They're reordering our financial system. They're doing all this skullduggery abroad in Europe and ruining our name and our reputation and our credit, as it may be. This was written on the 9th of July, 1921, or it was published anyway that day. And that's chapter 60. Well, thanks for listening to me today, and I'll be right back with you again real soon, and we'll close out volume 3.